we know that we want it, so don't let them stop it and go to the top. It's unlocked now. Let it take over.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Be Better podcast. We are again on a road trip. Today we are in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. We are at the Cycle Health offices here at 6545 Flying Cloud Drive, an address I know well historically, if you kind of know a little bit about the backstory. But we are joined today with an old dear friend of mine, and I had no accent on the old here. I apologize if that came off wrong. But Tony Schiller, welcome to the broadcast.
Thanks, Chris. Glad to be here.
How are you today?
I'm doing really well.
Yeah?
Beautiful day.
So something just came to my mind, and we have never talked about this. And forgive me if this becomes awkward or strange, but has anybody ever told you you look like George Clooney?
Absolutely not.
Really?
No.
So as I'm looking at you here, you know, you got like, you know, so I'll just kind of like articulate Tony Schiller to you if you're listening, you've never met or seen a photo of him, but he's got this like really perfect set of hair. It's a little bit silvery in the top. He's got a little bit of something going on in the front. Got the great chiseled jaw and a nice like full smile. And it just imagine George Clooney from ER in like an athletic shirt. And that's Tony.
Well, no benefits of that. I guess I should maybe replay that.
Okay. But nobody's ever told you that before.
No.
Okay. Well, now you have it. Okay. And never let it be said that I didn't compliment you on something completely outside
that's
the
true.
Box.
I better not let that one go to my head.
Okay. We'll sidestep that. Well, Tony, so you and I have known each other for a long time. Mm-hmm. And probably I've started out, I would say, watching you as a fan of the sport as I started growing up in triathlon, and you've always been part of, like, you know, the elite group, the best of the best, the guys that win and the people that I always watch stand on the podium and such. But one of the things that you and I have never talked about that I wanted to ask you today was, can you tell me how you found the sport? And you know, I know that you've been involved almost, you know, from the start of triathlon, and there's not that many of you out there.
No.
And even, tell me if I'm not mistaken, but you were nominee for the USA Triathlon Hall of Fame this year as well.
Oh, I wouldn't know about that.
Oh, you didn't know that.
No.
Ooh, cat's out of the bag. You were you're on the list, and I actually voted for you.
Oh,
so
interesting.
So what that tells me is that you have not only, I knew this before, but you have a huge history in the sport. So I think that a lot of people in a sport that doesn't have a lot of historical perspective, we tend to forget mm-hmm. things pretty quickly. You have an incredible memory of what it was like back before what it's like now. But this, when you started out, this might take you like kind of back to like high school. What sports did you do leading up to triathlon, and what was the trigger for you to kind of move into triathlon?
Well, okay, I can tell you I played all the sports as a kid, and was a boy who absolutely loved his bike and rode his bike everywhere and ran everywhere. So as a kid, I was running and biking, and I loved to swim.
Yeah.
But I was just short of being good enough to make the teams in junior high and high school.
Okay.
And so I was that last kid not to make the team in basketball. The last kid to not make the team in baseball. I've since gone back and looked at that and realized I was actually a pretty good athlete. I always convinced myself I was a terrible athlete, though, because I was cut. But these were good programs. These were teams that would go to state, and I was just missing. So I think if I was on a weaker program, I might have made those teams and never would have discovered running.
And where did you go to school?
I went to Highland Park.
Okay.
And what was really cool about that is I realized I wasn't going to make the teams there, and I decided to go up for running. And as a sophomore in high school, I was on the JV, and our team went and took third place in a one-tier cross-country state meet.
Like so one team meet?
No, excuse me, the one tier. So
I know,
Class B is all merged. So we took third place, and we were a powerful team, and I just assumed that's the way it's always going to be. I figured as a junior and as a senior, I'd be competing in the state meet. I'd eventually get there. Never did get to state.
Okay.
And left high school as a pretty good high school runner, won some small meets in St. Paul, but never got a scholarship, never got invited anywhere, and then ended up at Winona State, where I made All-American in the steeplechase. And was an all-conference runner and those things. So I developed into a pretty good runner in high school or in college. And then after college, went full on for the marathon.
Okay. How did you find steeplechase? Because a lot of people are, that's not like a very common, I would say, running form,
right,
especially here in the States.
Yep.
How did you come into to finding steeplechase as a as a collegiate athlete?
Well, it made perfect sense to me right out of the gate, seeing my very first steeple race as a freshman in college. And they were the sloppier, more heavy set distance runners. And then the mile and the 5K had your bean poles.
Yeah.
And I was always a husky kid for running.
Okay.
And so I just said, "Coach, let me try that. Those guys look like they're my kind of guy." And it was a brute race, and I loved it. I loved how we were going into the barrier at the water jump, and elbows were out, and you're kind of shoving each other. And I was able to shove the other guys more than they could shove me, and held my own zone. And before I knew it, I was, okay, this is my sport.
Cool.
And so I ran steeple hard for 4 years in college.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
So so what year did you graduate college?
1980,
man.
Yeah, like 400 years ago. Yeah.
I was taking a second to remember where I was in 1980.
Were you alive?
I was totally alive. I was born in 71, so I'd have been like, yeah, you know, it was
like in fifth grade.
No way.
Grade.
I wasn't, yeah, in fifth grade. I think, yeah, I was probably like second or third grade.
Yeah.
So little Chris here is yeah, here, and then Big Tony's graduating, yeah, from college. So what happens after college?
So the question about what made triathlon happen, already with the steeplechase, I was loving more of a big guy sport. I already, mm-hmm, loved to cycle. In college, I rode my bike everywhere. I never had a car. So I was doing those two. But I went to the Olympic trials in the marathon in 84.
Oh.
And 202 qualifiers. You had to run sub 219 to qualify in the marathon. And they had all of this information on all the riders or all the runners. And I was by far, not by a little bit, by far the heaviest in the field.
Really?
I was 177, 178. The next heaviest runner was a guy who was 152.
How tall?
That guy?
No, how tall were you?
Well, I was 6'1", and the guy who was 152 was like 6'4". So
wow,
he was also a beanpole. And, you know, Billy Rogers and guys like Dick Beardsley, Dick didn't run in that race, but he was injured. But these guys are 100, you know, buck 15, buck 25.
Yeah.
And I saw how much, I always thought of Alberto Salazar as this guy bigger than life. And then I saw him and he was a little guy. And I went, whoa. So at least in size compared to me.
Yeah.
So then flash forward one more year, summer of 85, came out of the trials, not motivated to focus on on marathoning anymore. But I went and watched a race. It was the Bud Light Triathlon Series in St. Paul.
Oh, yeah.
And they had a thing on the news about it. I said, I'm going to go check it out. And the big four were there. Mark Allen, Dave Scott, Scott Tinley, and Mike Scott Molina.
Oh,
three
Molina,
of the Scots.
Okay.
And, yep, and that was a race Molina won. And I watched these guys, and especially Dave Scott. He looked like he had the same frame as me. Now, I looked at that, and I watched these guys, and a little arrogance here, but I said, I can outrun these boys. I know I can outrun them. They were fast, but,
yeah,
but I actually could outrun them. Of course, they also could swim a 16-minute mile,
yeah,
which I would not ever be able to do, but that was... That was the idea, and that happened to be the week before, I was at Phelan, the week before Turtleman.
Okay.
So I raced in Turtleman that following Saturday.
So that was the genesis. They,
yeah,
they just totally motivated,
yeah,
you.
Absolutely.
I couldn't imagine, first of all, have witnessing one of those races, because those guys were, and still, like, they still come out every once in a while. You see them. And they're still involved in the sport to some,
yeah,
extent. I actually swam Dave Scott's Masters once,
out
at Flatirons in Boulder. He totally made fun of me when I was there because I was swimming with a pole buoy.
Oh, sure he would.
And he's like, you know, Chris, why don't you lose the pole buoy? It ain't, yeah, ain't wreck swim. And I was like, okay, I'm totally embarrassed.
Well, this will be funny. So it's 85. Everyone was wearing fishnet helmets, drop handlebars, shifters on the frame, pedal clips. You know, the straps for,
yeah,
the shoes.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of them were wearing tennis shoes, but most of them changed. They all had running shorts on the bike, and
wow,
they all raced without a shirt on. And every one of the guys had, maybe two of them had disc wheels. I think not, though. I think because Steve Head was just about ready to roll with his business, and I don't think he had them on disc wheels. He might have, But
like a solid disc wheel or like a cover?
Well, Steve had the first ones, and yeah. he had those guys on. I think he was dealing with all of them, really. I think he had Mark Allen and those guys in the early years racing. But the wheels were out probably in about 85, so I think they probably had them. But they rode a different kind of style. And by the way, no wetsuits that day. Ooh. And I don't know if it was because it was so warm, just you didn't wear a wetsuit that often. So yeah. the sport was all throwback.
Was this back when Mark Allen was racing it with the Huffy branded bikes?
No, he didn't have that yet. And that's when those were actually a carbon aero frame yeah. bike. This was all round tube bikes, man, and thin rims. So oh, yeah, man. So it was pretty funny. We right about that time might have had a guy or two with clips, but right about that time we started seeing everybody get the clips, and then having things change quickly.
Yeah. So you go and race Turtle Man.
Yeah.
Lights the fire inside of you.
Oh, totally.
Okay. So then it just pretty much straight fast forward. How did you do in your first race?
Okay. So I love telling this story, but so I go out and I signed up. They had a registration on site where you could go to the Shoreview Community Center or something on Friday night. And I went in and signed up, and I said, how do you start tomorrow? And they said, well, we have you in like the fifth wave. And I said, fifth wave? I want to be in the first wave, right? They go, no, you can't. And then the race director said, you're going to be better off in the fifth wave. And so just don't worry about that. Well, I was thinking this is lame, right? Mm-hmm. Going to go off with all the old people. And I get there, and I look at the dudes that are heading out in the water, and, of course, they're all much more chiseled as triathletes. And when the pack went out and I got to really see them go, I realized, I don't know how to swim. So this is probably good. And my group I sprinted into the water just fine, but about 100 yards in, I'm floundering.
Okay.
And I did, I think it was a mile. It was international distance. I think I did a 35-minute mile. And it was my first swim of the year.
Wow.
So I floundered. And the top guys, I think that day, Dave Dow won the race. And Dave, I think, did like a 22 or 23. And he wasn't even a strong swimmer. But there's another guy in the race that just clobbered the swim in like 19. And so I was 16 minutes behind and waves back. And then I had my old clunker co-op bike. It was about $125 bike. And I flatted with about 4 miles to go. I rode in on the flat.
Oh, jeez.
On the rear wheel. And then I jumped off the bike and I ran a 31 flat 10K.
Nice.
And I won the run split.
Oh, of course. That's a smoking split even now.
So I did. I think I ended up at something like, 2:30 or something for the race. And the winners were around 2 hours.
Okay. Right?
So, but I finished that race and I was born again. I mean, I've been born again twice in my life. That was the first time. And I realized that I've been floundering for a year since the trials and the marathon, not kind of wayward. What do I want to do next? And I knew it. This is it. I'm going to dedicate my life to triathlon as an athlete. And it was just a certainty.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So that Turtle Man, was at that time still like more in the fall. Correct?
Yeah, it was late August.
Okay, so yeah. In Minnesota, that's pretty much when it starts to snow.
Yeah.
Or close. Can be. Exactly. So just one race that year?
No.
Did you get another one?
Back the precursor to Lifetime, and it went away for about a decade, was the U.S. Bally's.
Yes.
U.S. Swim and Fitness, Bally's Swim and Fitness. And that was, they had it at Harriet.
Oh,
and,
really?
Yeah. And so I went and did that in the sprint version the following weekend because it had a full international, and I just thought, I really struggled in the swim. I practiced swimming all week, and I did the sprint.
All week?
Yeah, yeah. and I borrowed a bike from this guy who did the previous week. I did a relay, and I outran his relay partner, who was supposed to be an ace runner.
Okay.
And he said, if you use my bike, you could really fly. And so I had a race bike.
Nice.
And in the swim, I did a little better in the swim because I didn't die in 800. And then biked pretty fast. And I actually finished, I think, third in the sprint. I didn't realize it wasn't, the competitive race.
Oh.
But so all the guys that were really fast in the international crushed me by time. Their time was better than mine cut in half.
Oh, wow.
So if I doubled my time, I would not have finished anyone here.
Oh, well, yeah. But that was a big race in its day. I mean,
that was like it is now. It's 1,500 or 1,200 people.
Where'd they have the transition?
You know, the band shell wasn't there. They had a big parking lot area.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a good lake. And, yeah. But I thought that race had always been at Nokomis.
No, it did. It moved the very next year to Nokomis.
Okay.
Because I came back and did it the next year as the, you know, as a competitor in the main race.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So you get this bug, you start to light the fire. When does the gear shift change to you? When do you start winning races or getting on podiums?
Well, we had some pretty good athletes. There's, of course, Mo Mao, I call him Mo. Yeah. Montgomery Mao was a stud, and he was just a young guy. He had a senior year left at Eau Claire. And then we had Matt Haugen, and Dave Dow was ridiculous on the bike. He'd go out and put a 28 miles an hour, you know, time down. He was just screaming on the bike in those early days of the sport. And he was old. He was like 30, right? You know, and I was 28 by that point. And let's see. So Bob Mock was really good. And a guy named Jim Grafe and a guy named Carl Trabant. Okay. So all of these guys were good athletes. In 87 or 86, I did six races and I got remember pretty well. I got 2/3, 2/4, and 2/5 in my. So I became a competitor, but Matt was winning and Mo was winning. I think Bob Mock won one of the races and Jim Grafe. So I wasn't winning, and I went home at the end of 86, and I said, "Okay, time to dig my well. You know, it's time to get my work." And so It was really about Labor Day, and I went into about a 9-month. I went and got coaching, spent a lot of time with Tim Walton at that point and other swim coaches. I knocked that swim time down from probably 28 in the mile down to 19 one year. And even though it looked awful and I'm sloppy in the water, still am, but it's efficient underwater. It's really messy above water. Started really getting the bike, and it was mostly trainer workouts, 1-, 2-, 3-hour workouts. And I would watch those old Ironman cassettes, the VCR in the basement, and sweat all over the concrete floor on my trainer. Actually, on rollers.
Oh, wow.
I used rollers and just would pound. And so the first race of 87 was my first win. And this is kind of a funny story. I have no clue. We used to start the Independence Triathlon, 650 racers, one wave. And he just sent us out, 100 yards out, and he had a right-hand turn.
What? Oh, jeez.
And I'm better swimmer, but still not an elite swimmer. And I take my right-hand turn, and it's just a ton of people. And I swim the 800 down, and then we get out of the water, hop on the bikes, and I'm sprinting on the bike. And it's a sprint race, so around 10 miles, I catch Mo. And I look at him, and I go, you know, how many ahead? And he looks and he goes, "You're winning, you stupid," you know, use some vernacular. And I went, what? So I came into transition, and that was my first race using clip-in pedals.
Okay.
And I didn't know how to do a transition. So I got there, but I had never, you know, mastered this whole thing about coming to a stop, getting the feet out.
Yep.
And so I brought the bike, and you could ride right to your rack, full speed to the rack, and then I brake, and then I tried to get my feet out, and I just went,
timber.
Crashed to the ground. And I'm struggling to get my feet out with the bike on, and I'm panicking because I got to run fast. And
you're the only one in transition.
I'm the only one in transition. So the whole crowd's watching and laughing at this guy tipped over. And so then I got out and I ran a really fast 5K and won the race, and that was my first win.
Oh, that's awesome.
1987.
That had to feel so good.
It was a real high because we had the top guys were racing and that was at that point I knew okay, this can go somewhere.
Yeah
Because I really respected Mo and Carl, and they both were super fast, and to beat those guys when I know they were going for it, that was big.
And it's amazing when you think back as to, you know, the how the Midwest has produced some really great athletes,
yeah.
right? I mean, and you wouldn't think of like Minnesota being the production area of that. And, you know, I would say if you went, you know, North, South Dakota, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, this is the Midwest. We've produced some amazing athletes. I mean, not only did we produce the last American to win the Hawaiian Ironman with Tim DeBoom, but, you know, some of the really the best age groupers, you know, Greg Taylor and has won Grandmaster, you know, for how many times, you know, having that weird hat and always doing the Arnold Schwarzenegger imitation, you know, it's like you just get into it, but you kind of take it for granted.
Yeah.
You know, you go out, if you were to say, go to like, you know, the Mideast or whatever, you wouldn't have some of those same people. And I never got a true appreciation of that until I went to Nationals and then went to Worlds. And I think you and I went to Worlds at the same time back in 2005 when I was in Hawaii.
Yeah.
And you just got to see like, wow, like these are all, you know, our Minnesotans are actually really good. And so maybe to kind of have to come over that hump and you're in the very beginning was a huge, probably a huge progressive win for you.
Right.
Because you didn't, it wasn't like you got your first win in a soft area.
No. And I think, I always had aspirations, having been a marathoner and runner that traveled and did big races. I knew as soon as I could win locally and at a consistent level that I was going to test it elsewhere. And so that opened up. Ultimately, I had done my first. Well, I guess that would be 2 + 6. That was my ninth triathlon. And so winning that race, in effect, was a key to the doorway of travel. So prior to that, I hadn't even thought about going anywhere.
Okay.
And then all of a sudden, okay, we're going to take this places.
Yeah. And then now when you're doing that, back in that time frame, did you have like sponsors? Did you start to pick up like at what point in time did people start recognizing you and saying, hey, we want to support you? Because travel's not cheap.
No.
I mean, I can imagine, and travel's not cheap now. And I can imagine back then it was probably pretty much the same thing to travel around. Were people, were they as eager to help? Like athletes like you back then?
I've been awfully blessed to have a lot of support, very little support in the way of funding. I could probably count that on, I guess, a couple trips to the cash card machine, right?
Yeah.
So, but an actual product and health club memberships and things of that nature, race entry fees, had a lot of support and a lot of encouragement. So initially, I remember after the 86 or for the 86 season, I wanted to get a bike, made a commitment, and I decided I could afford $600,
okay.
which even then wasn't much.
Okay.
Right? So I went to some shops around town. I won't name any of the ones that did this to me, but I said, look, and I was naive, right? Mm-hmm. I said, I want to buy a world-class race bike and I have $600. And almost every bike shop laughed. And then I talked to Pat Sorensen at Penn Cycle, and I didn't realize he was Elmer's son, and Elmer started Penn Cycle, and he said, well, $600, yeah, you know, you tell you what. He says, I think you can get a pretty good bike. Why don't you get this bike here? And he said, it's a nice steel frame. And he says, go out and do well in a race. And if you do really well, then I'll let you use the shop race wheels.
Oh?
And I went, oh, okay. So right away he respected me and he gave me dignity. He didn't laugh at me. And after the first race, I got fifth place. And he goes, well, here's the shop wheels. By the end of the summer, he says, well, hang on a second. He calls Steve Head and he says, hey, this guy's doing really well. He's finishing top five in the races. And Steve says, have him come over to the house and I'll give him a disc wheel. So, and by the end of 87, when I started winning races, all of a sudden Pat calls me up and he says, hey, there's this company called Nishiki. We sell their bikes. They want to give you a Dura Ace bike.
Ooh.
And I went, wow. So then it was Dura Ace. And then it was Schwinn on the a Prologue or Paramount race bike with Dura Ace. And then it was Trek.
Mm-hmm.
And then along the way, Gear West showed up. And so I ended up joining Jan and eventually Kevin at Gear West during the days when Penn Cycle kind of moved a little bit away from triathlon and then Gear West was all in.
Yeah.
So then Kevin and Jan helped me for years with different bikes and now I've had help from Diamondback. So I guess I've kind of gone the full gamut.
I remember seeing a photo of you in the changing room. Now this sounds weird again. At Gear West, where you're wearing the jersey and you kind of have, I think it was like a titanium frame over your shoulder.
Oh, yeah.
It was like your senior picture. And I was like, wow.
Yeah, I think that was one of my speaking flyers.
I know. I thought it was like a poster. Like, yeah. I was like, oh man, that guy must be awesome. He's got his own poster.
Well.
I remember that was like my first time like seeing you. Like, wow, I want to be like that. I want to be like that guy. And so you race for quite a few years, and then you moved from just winning local races to now competing nationally and uh-huh. competing at nationals, and then eventually going to worlds and doing pretty well.
Right.
Tell me about like your first time going to worlds. And where was it, and what was that experience like racing at a world level versus just like at a national level or a Midwest level?
Sure. Well, I raced, of course, professionally for a while and had some big races, the biggest being, I suppose, Ironman in Hawaii,
mm-hmm.
and been there a bunch of times, but four to be exact, I guess. But as an amateur in 1994, I raced in the 5 to 39 division at my first Worlds in New Zealand, and that was in Wellington, and unbelievable experience in one perspective, and that was that an area that I think had 400,000 residents brought out 200,000 of them on the course.
What?
Yeah. So think about kind of the size of Minneapolis, just the city itself, and having a race where they would have 200,000 people on the race course.
Just watching and cheering.
Yeah. So because it was a world championship and they were stoked that it was coming to their country, and it was ridiculous. And so that had a super intense bike course that had massive climbs and descents. And just like the Tour de France, they just flooded the street. And they move for you at the last second.
Oh, geez.
And that was really a cool experience because I figured out there was no room, and I had all sorts of age groupers ahead of me on the bike, and there's no room to move with the crowd in tight. And somewhere along the line, it dawned on me, they know how to move out of the way. So I just created my own lane and shot through and shot by everybody, and the crowd just moved at the last second so you could get through.
Oh, wow.
And that was so fun.
Oh, cool. I would be scared. I'd be like nervous as all get out.
Oh,
like,
yeah. I was like, move. And then I realized I didn't even have to let them know I'm coming. They just moved.
They just automatically did it.
Yeah.
Oh, it's like, I have a hard enough time watching that on TV. I couldn't imagine actually being there. That would freak me out. But New Zealand's a beautiful area, and you must have loved that, and that kind of just sealed it up. And
it's heaven, yeah.
And so let's get these the two buckets. So how many times have you raced in Kona in the World Championships at Ironman?
Four times.
And where did you qualify for those?
Gosh, I qualified for the first one as a pro in Bakersfield, the Bakersfield Triathlon.
Okay.
And then I did the next three. Let's see, 96 was probably at Springfield.
Okay.
And 98 would have been at, that'd be the Panama City. They had a half Ironman there.
Okay.
And won that race. And that was the one at age 40. I won the race outright, which was kind of cool, and qualified. And I wasn't going to do Ironman that year. That was the year I turned 40. But winning that race and having the slot, I just went to it to do it, and then, oh crap, I guess I'm going to do the Ironman again. And then so that became the big push that year. And then 2003, I did the Vine Man.
Okay.
So
that's a good one. For those of you listening that are, would say, well, how did you qualify at those races? Back in the day, it was not, you could qualify at non-Ironman distance races.
Right.
And it was, because there wasn't that many Ironmans around.
No, but it was just as tough because I've been really blessed and really fortunate to have these opportunities, but it's, I think in all but one of them, you had to win your age group.
Yeah.
So there would be
in a very competitive
120, 150 people in the group, and you had to win. So it's not like there's any breathing room.
Yep.
And Vineman, there was one slot for men 40 to 50. Is that right? What year was that? 2003, whatever it was. Yeah, I think it was one slot. And mm-hmm. so I had to beat the, I think at that when I had to beat the 40 to 44s as a 45 to 49. So I was really lean and it's such a hard race to get into.
And so it's not like it was never easy. It's never been easy to get to Hawaii. No. And it's just that it's the entry points have changed and everything. How do you feel the change in the point qualification system is compared to what it was? Do you think it's advantageous for the sport? Do you think it's harmful for the sport that pros now have to acquire enough points to go, or do you think it still should be, you know, you get it at one shot?
Yeah, I don't know that much about that, Chris, in terms of how it's, I know about the points, but I don't know how it's impacted the who gets to go and who doesn't go in terms of people who miss out. I think the race always seems to have the caliber athlete that you want, and it seems like there's the big issue they always have, Hawaii, the biggest issue, it was even when I did it last in 2003, but you just don't have any room on that course to not be in a draft position. So you're so stressed out for the first 80 miles of the bike, in effect braking and backing up to avoid running up on someone's wheel. And if you're a person who has integrity and ethic and you're not looking for motorcycles, but you're actually trying to play by the rules, it's really stressful to ride 80 miles trying to keep 10 meters between you and the next bike when you have literally miles of riders that are all 10 meters apart.
Oh, yeah.
And if you get out in the left, then you're in a blocking position.
Yep.
So it's so I don't know how they could. I think they've probably found the right number for the pro ranks so that they can actually race and not be drafting.
Yeah.
And anymore, you're just going to have a draft fest, so.
Yeah, it's not like, I'm not sure if you saw any of the video footage from Ironman Texas this year.
Oh, I heard about it.
Yeah, and I'm not sure what the details were as to why, but what I read was that it was actually deemed not safe to officiate, and so there's no officials out in the course, and being a closed course, I mean, some of the packs at like mile 80 were, you know, like six guys wide and 20 deep, and I do think that comes down to the individual has to at some point in time either want to participate as a fair athlete where they're not going to participate into that point, or they're going to just go along with it because you know there's no officials out there, that you're not going to get a penalty, so why not do it? And I remember doing Worlds in Hawaii back in 2005, and it's kind of the same thing. So as an individual athlete, I thought, okay, you can't draft, blah, 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 blah. And then seeing packs of like, you know, 10, 12 guys that are from different countries all working together, passing you. And it's like, you just think, well, that's not fair. Like, I'm doing it right. How come they're not? And it's like, nobody sees it and they're not going to get dinged. So do you jump on and say, and say, well, I'm going to sacrifice my integrity just for a result? Or am I going to still play my game and be 100% okay with however it shakes out?
Right.
You know, and that's a hard space to be at, especially for some people who are very type A driven. They may not have that.
It's been a thing that I've been vocal about, probably at times in a way that I'd like to take back and not be so harsh on people, but I've just made the decision. The reality is we take this way too seriously, and we think that something's going to be made right in a life that isn't quite right by winning a race and by proving yourself out there in competition. And the reality is I've been really, really fortunate, and I've been really blessed and had some great, great accomplishments. And I don't mean that to say I'm great, but the accomplishments have been really wonderful. But I can tell you that some of the most lonely moments of my life have been the drive home after a race. And I've had to kind of reconcile that. And that was after winning a race, going home and thinking, you know, I was a really big shot today and I just kicked butt. And hardly anybody acknowledged me. And I'm driving home and I'm alone on the ride, and I'm going to get home, and it's 2 weeks before I get to race again and have that search for meaning.
Yeah.
And in those moments, I it's really what brought me to become a person of faith and come back to, in my case, a Christian. But it made me start asking different questions about when is it going to be enough? When are you going to win a big enough prize that you're going to feel good about yourself? And I came to the conclusion that there wasn't, even if I could go to Hawaii and win my age group, it wouldn't make me feel like, okay, now everything fits together.
Interesting.
The reality is what's made me feel the best is just knowing that I'm utilizing the gifts that I've been given.
Yeah.
And that I'm hopefully acknowledging and inspiring and maybe sharing with others in a way that's helpful and not so self-consumed. As it was, I think, for my first half of life.
Yeah. So I think in a nutshell, you're saying that you're getting more out of giving back and helping others than you were in your own accomplishment.
It was some of the most lonely times in my life were when I was winning the most. And
I think that's an incredibly powerful statement right there.
Yeah. I raced winning and I noticed, and I won't. There's lots of guys I've shared with some of them in person, but there's some guys out there that never beat me who I consider to be, and at the time I considered them to be stronger men, better humans than me, and I was beating them, but I was watching how they were admired in the race, and I wanted to be more like that.
Interesting.
So I learned too from people that are out there, but that gave me, I guess that's probably the seed, that feeling and wanting to have my life be more important than just about winning some races. And this ties to drafting. It's very easy for me to see a pack go by. I don't like it. I might get a little ticked off, but I will not jump in with the pack.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, I'm going to look in the mirror and say, I did this race.
Yep.
And I pulled it off on my own. And people can say what they want about me, but I've been racing for 46 years. I've been clean. I don't even know where you would go to get gas. I don't even know who you would talk to. But I've never considered it because I want to go to my grave and meet my maker and know that I think I did the race about as well as I can. And I'm sure I fell short, but I tried. And as far as those feelings, I guess, are what drove me to start getting involved, you know, as I have been for the last 15 years with kids races.
Yeah.
And you've talked about this as a coach, that it's been more meaningful for you to see one of your athletes be a victor than for you to do really well and set a personal best.
Yep.
I've had some of my most precious moments watching kids have a breakthrough. Physically, where they discover I can do this, and I didn't know I had the ability, and realizing, you know, I played a little role. I created an event that motivated them and inspired them and gave them an opportunity. Because you know the way it is today with kids, they're so programmed in sports, and they're not programmed for our sport.
Yep.
And most of them will never experience riding the bicycle without their parents. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about that.
Yeah.
They'll go all the way through high school, and they've never once just got on their bike and rode by themselves. That's how I got around everywhere as a kid.
Yeah.
And see, these kids are transported. Independent mobility is gone. They don't ever experience that. They get to our race, and they take off, and they race, and they leave their parents behind. And it's the first time in their life that they're actually on a bike and not with their parent.
That's amazing.
And it's a really cool thing for a kid to experience. And not every kid, but a lot of them are raised that way.
Yeah.
And it opens a door, I hope, for a kid who maybe at 13 or 14 or 15 says, I don't think I want to do team sports anymore. And that's about half of all kids by about 13 years old say that maybe they could say, I could do something else. I could go out for swimming. Yep. I could go out for track. Maybe I could join our school's mountain bike team. I could be a triathlete.
Yep.
And planting that seed.
It's that, and you know, that's going to go into our second part of our conversation.
Okay.
We'll take a break here, and we'll come back to part two, and we're going to bring in your cohort, and Betsy, we'll talk about cycle health. We'll talk about how that kind of began, mm-hmm. and there's a story there as to like that genesis,
yeah.
and some unique. I would say relationships that you had not only with adults, but with I would say one kid in particular who probably I think had touched. I think I know that with me brought my kids into triathlon, mm-hmm. too. And but we'll save that for part two.
Sounds good.
So Tony, I thank you for sitting down with me today, and we'll we'll come back and I look forward to this to the part two of our conversation. Mm-hmm. And when we bring this back around, and we'll go full circle.
Okay. Well, Chris, for all your listeners, it's really cool in the second phase too. I'm in that second phase where I'm in decline, and it's a hard phase to enter. But once you get into it and you recognize it, it's really fun. It's fun to race where you're in a place where you're enjoying it and having fun, and there's nothing left to prove. There's only the opportunity to improve as a person doing the sport. So for you athletes that are in the part of life where you're still getting better, go for it. I'd love to encourage you in that way. And for those that are starting to get to I'm in decline now.
Yeah.
We can talk more about that too, but it's a wonderful time to shift the focus from aren't I fast to, wow, what can I do with this gift of movement that I love so much and do for the rest of my life?
It's an opportunity, not a hindrance.
Yeah.
Because I think people think of getting old and getting slow as like as a consequence, but it's really an opportunity, because if you look at it through the right lenses, it now opens up a whole new window and a whole new scope that can remotivate you, revitalize you, and make things even I would say more substantial than they were even back like in the days when you were winning.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you for spending the first half of this with us, and we can't wait to have the second half of this conversation. But we invite you back. And as always, if you enjoy what you heard, please subscribe to us on iTunes, and then give us some feedback in the comments section below. And also give us a couple of stars there if you feel. And if you don't like us, then just hold your comments. Just kidding. Thank you, everybody. And we'll talk to you soon. Bye.